looks at night. I'm moving as fast as a madman's mind.
UMFM, we can handle the truth. In fact, it's necessary that we hear it in order for you to have a great listening experience. We are looking for your feedback, whether it's good or bad. We need to know what you really think. Email your comments to feedback@umfm.com and play your part in making UMFM a great listening experience.
Good evening and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Farah Hustek, an independent curator and director based in London, UK. She is currently the curator of London's Spreeze Sculpture, a major annual public art exhibition taking place in Regent's Park in September 2023, along Frieze London and Frieze Masters. Farah graduated with an MA from the Contemporary Art Theory Department at Goldsmiths College, London, after completing her BA in Mathematics and a degree in Film Studies at Özyurt University in Istanbul. She has held many national and international directorial and curatorial positions for institutions in the UK, such as the Liverpool Biennale and the 40th Akbank in Istanbul, and curating mid to large scale not-for-profit exhibitions such as the FIG 2, 50 exhibitions, 50 weeks at the Institute of Contemporary Art in London, and the 10th Gwangju Biennale in South Korea. Farah has commissioned a number of public art projects, including Dohosu in London, and has taken on multiple jury roles for national and international art prizes, such as the London Turner Prize in 2020. She holds governance roles in art organizations in the UK, such as the chair of New Contemporaries, and the Netherlands on the advisory board of the Jan van Eyck Academy. Farah shares her experiences as a speaker for various events, is currently working on a new model for art institutions to be published as a book in 2023. She writes regularly for academic publications, art magazines, artist monographs, and exhibition catalogs. She acts as editorial advisor and contributing editor to Extra Extra magazine. She's a member of the International Association of Art Critics and founding member of the Association of Women in the Arts in the UK. She is listed in the Celebratory Apollo 40 Under 40 Thinkers section in 2018, included in Evening Standard's Progress 1000 London's Most Influential People, and in Artsy's Top 20 Most Influential Young Curators in Europe, and more. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for the invitation and for having me.
Over the course of your career, you've been highly recognized for your extensive curatorial work, exhibitions, publications, teaching, and more. What originally drew you into the field of curating, and what do you enjoy most about your work?
I didn't know that I was set up to become a curator when I actually started working in the arts. So as you've mentioned, I have a maths degree and I've been trained to become a mathematician from my family as well. So I think I would say it was curiosity and a passion for art. And then also I think early on, I was wise enough to understand that my level of creativity, even though I do think I am a creative worker, is not the same as the level of creativity that artists have. So that was very good for me to discover that, so that I could actually engage my labor, energy, enthusiasm for working with artists and making their ideas happen.
Can you tell us about your academic background that you mentioned in math and film and fine arts and studio programs, and share a little about how this diverse training contributes to your curatorial interests and experience?
I think it contributes massively. And I think we are also in an era where cross-disciplinarity and transdisciplinarity in practices that are artistic, curatorial, editorial, or even like in other sectors that are outside of the arts is becoming more and more important and also poignant to make advancements in the way you think and produce a project. I do believe that the fact that I was trained in maths has given me another, let's say, a framework of thinking and mindset. It's the language that you almost understand the world and interpret the world. Even though I'm not actively working in the area of mathematics, I am still inherently working with ideas of looking at and approaching things. And I feel that has given me, without my knowledge, it has given me this credibility to think outside the box. And in most of my projects, and also when I work with artists, this approach sometimes has become an asset for me or worked in my benefit to then take problems outside of where they are and find solutions to them, or approach ideas, concepts, themes, and even curating that we might explore later from that mathematical mindset or scientific method has enabled me also to understand the artistic method better.
In 2015, you took on an incredible curatorial project for the Institute of Contemporary Art in London, featuring a series of 50 shows in 50 weeks. Can you tell us about this project and maybe walk us through a little of the preparation, curatorial process, and collaborations that were involved?
That's the perfect project to bring up after the maths, because I think it literally is an embodiment of how I brought my formation in maths to the arts. So FIG2, 50 exhibitions in 50 weeks, or 50 projects in 50 weeks, is a revival of a seminal project called FIG1, which took place in London in the year 2000, which predates Tate Modern, predates Frieze, predates 135 commercial galleries operating actively in the London's art scene. So FIG2 was literally 15 years later. My wish would be there would be a FIG3 in 2030 and FIG4 in 2045. So a bit like Münster Sculpture Projects, or a bit like Documenta, it maps the time and culminates an understanding of artistic practices of that particular time. Because the year 2000, it was almost like a FIG1 acted as a catalyst of contemporary art scene's evolution in the UK, because the UK was still behind what was going on in Europe. We still had very traditional galleries still selling impressionist paintings, nothing wrong with them, but the contemporary art scene was much smaller and the YBA was just still a niche group. So after 15 years, when, let's say, the forces came together, that is Mark Francis, who curated FIG1, who is now one of the directors of Gagosian, and Candida Gatler, who is a co-founder of Outset Philanthropic Contemporary Art Fund, came together, and then ICA joined to then revive this project. And they found the budget, and then the last thing was found a curator. So I was appointed 2.5 months before the opening of my first show at the ICA. And the studio was our space. But of course, it needed renovation and thinking. So it wasn't like a project that I actually had a year to plan and that's what happened. I was just 2 weeks in, returning to London after delivering the biennial in South Korea. Sometimes it happens, things snowball in your life. So you do one big project and then the second literally comes together. So I curated the program as we went along. And maths really helped me because I studied topology. So you construct these, let's say, nominal fields, and then you are testing ideas there. And once the test is sound, you bring it to the reality plane. So a bit like that, I had to construct the whole 50 shows. And my ambition and passion is to my detriment, in the sense that I didn't want to repeat what FIG1 was, with which the formula was similar, but one work at a time that gets picked from a studio, showcased in this Georgian townhouse in Tottenham Court Road, and then moves on. But I thought in 2015, artistic practices have proliferated. Artists come from different backgrounds, work with different disciplines, and it's even more cross-disciplinary. So I thought I need to really keep the pulse of the moment, but also respond to what is happening right now. What kind of exhibitions do we need? What kind of art do we like to see, etc.? So then created this dream of connecting every show to one another. So that it's almost like, imagine a long train with 50 compartments. So you go from one compartment to another on a weekly basis that changes in color, in structure, in smell, in texture, and then this goes on. But that was not enough because I thought people wouldn't come every week to a show that I curated. Even my closest friends failed me. They were like, sorry, we need to have a life. We can't live your life. I was like, no, this week is so good. Don't miss it. But there were people who did come to all the exhibitions. So I thought, okay, what could I create? Because I've been very interested in also like institutional practices. And I wanted to position FIG2 as a non-institutional institution with a vision, with also a budget, a framework, a team, but also this unprecedented potential of risk-taking. I wanted this throughout the whole project, that it was consistent so that a person who came to week 2, week 17, week 35, week 45, they would still feel that, okay, this is FIG2, the flavor, the atmosphere, the energy, the, let's say, depth of knowledge production is consistent. So that was important. So in that sense, if you've ever played this game, Snakes and Ladders, where you throw the dice and then you go to numbers and then that number sometimes makes you fall back, etc. So then I decided, okay, I will have a thematic consistency throughout the exhibition, but I will also have joint, let's say, areas of looking at a specific subject matter, working with a specific medium or an artistic sensitivity that crosses through the whole program. And topology really helped me to do that because I would identify some artists for, let's say, the month of January and some artists for February, but then some artists for September. And to think about like, okay, I want to start with the line, like in art, but then really have performance focus, etc. So at the end of 2015, we actually had this diagram of connections from artists, practices, materials, subject matters, and also methodologies that were repeated. Because for me, what was important was that FIG1 was this predictor of future greats. Like Mona Hatoum had her show, Runa Islam had her first show after graduating from Goldsmiths, Jeremy Deller had his first solo show at FIG1, or then there was Patti Smith giving a concert, or Pierre Hugh. They were all seminal names that FIG1 engaged with and generated. So I thought with FIG2, it's not only about the artist name or individuality of the artist anymore, but all the artists and their practices for me are the ones that will be part of our future. So I didn't want to keep on that individuation of future grades, but to make it much more practice centric, and knowing maths really helped.
Your practice involves a great deal of writing, such as exhibition catalogs, which can be very enhancing for the audience experience, especially for a project of such magnitude as the ICA shows. Can you tell us about the exhibition catalog for the ICA project, maybe some of the challenges it presented in the process of writing it?
Writing is very important for me, and it is not like curator that writes or I'm a writer that curates. For me, they're like two separate practices, but they inform one another. And sometimes they go in parallel. Sometimes you have to focus on one, like at the moment I'm writing, even though I'm still curating. And sometimes I curate more and then write less. So they have these precedents, but it's almost like a muscle that you need to keep fit on both sides. And for FIG2, it was very important to do a publication. FIG1, again, the publication was 50 posters that were designed by the artist each week. And then there's a special compilation of it, which is signed by each artist. That's like the precious archival treasure. So I thought, okay, this time we can't do 50 posters because FIG2 is actually a whole project that is together and that has crossovers. The name FIG was borrowed from Marcel Brotauers. Marcel Brotauers mostly refers to his practice or his artworks as FIG1, FIG2, FIG17. And then FIG is a short version of figure. So that means it is an illustration of an idea in its becoming. It is a representation of something. So I thought the FIG publication can't be the catalog per se, but it could treat the documentation of the exhibitions and illustrations of ideas that the artists had in the first place, because 90% of the program were new commissions. So we literally made new works happen throughout the whole program. So then when you look at the catalog, you will see that each picture, because we have the publication starts with 100 pages of pictures, it's like a picture book, but each picture has these, let's say, annotations, 11, E, D, A. And what we've done is when we were writing about that 11th week, we were referring to C as in 11E. C as in 11A, so that it's almost like the book in itself creates correspondence. And then we also wanted to connect weeks to another. And so there were arrows for more insights or further articulation of different practices. You can jump to another page with this multiple choice crime novels where, you know, if you think the cook is the killer, jump to page 170. And if you think it's actually the maid, then you go to another page. So it was a bit like that. So it was about bringing the correlations that happened throughout the whole program. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to also bring in external viewpoints and understandings of what FIG2 did. Because for me, my overarching theme was to produce FIG2 as a study of aesthetic and critical currency of our times. So then I interviewed with Hans-Ulrich Obrist, and we speculated about the future of institutions. But then commissioned Caroline Douglas, who is the director of Contemporary Art Society, to write about the future of philanthropy in the arts, because FIG2 was because I ended up quadrupling the production budget and getting some public funding, but let's say 92% of FIG2 budget was private. So then it was very important to also really bring that. And I think I wouldn't be able to take as many risks if I had publicly funded budget. And this we can also go into depth about why that is. And then invited Catherine Wood to look at the performativity that the program had throughout, because we had openings every week, every Monday, closing every Sunday. But we also ended up generating 148 events that were in the form of artist talks, film screenings, discussions, debates. I delivered a curatorial seminar program. So it was literally, and not only visually, but discursively buzzing factory almost. And I felt sometimes like I was the mad woman in the attic, because ICA Studio is slightly on the second floor of the building.
Can you highlight a few of your writing pieces or publications that were most engaging for you?
With pleasure. So like my curating, because I curate at institutions or exhibitions that are in the white cube, and I also curate in the public realm, or I curate festivals. So the scales differ. And same thing with my writing. I work in creative writing, but I also do academic writing and also do reviews and texts that are on artworks. For the creative writing, I have this ongoing series which hasn't finished, and I started almost 10 years ago, actually. So I have this brand, it's called Moment Over Time Records Proudly Presents. And then I pick two song titles that resonate the artwork that I'm writing about or the experience that I want to convey in the text. I love those series. Maybe one day it becomes a book in its own right. I think I already have 7 or 8 iterations that either was delivered as a public lecture or appeared in biennial readers or appeared in exhibition catalogs. It always takes different form. And the second type of writing, maybe we can talk a little bit about the book that I'm working on right now, is more sectoral thinking. And I've been very interested in looking at the systems and structures that art happens. And especially, as you mentioned, running institutions have given me a good experience of looking at what could we do as institutions to catch up with the times, but also at the same time, align with our core purpose, if I may say. And for me, that would be working with artists and making art happen. So I'm now writing a book that is a bit like a manifesto, but a bit like an overview, where I also draw examples of excellence from across the world, interviewing directors of institutions or independent curators, looking at what could be the institution of tomorrow. And trying to build some applicable solutions for hopefully institutions to take on to transform, because that's what we need on the brink of a societal change. Institutions need to reflect and mirror that change.
The artist Conrad Shawcross currently has a fascinating exhibition at the University of Oxford's Mathematical Institute entitled Cascading Principles, Expansions with Geometry, Philosophy and Interference that opened last September, and you've curated and organized in collaboration with Oxford Mathematics. With your background in mathematics, it must be an exciting opportunity for you to curate this show and work with Conrad Shawcross. Can you tell us a little about this artist and your experience curating such an exhibition?
Thank you. That's been quite amazing, actually. And I don't know, maybe if we think about life and coincidences and serendipity, or perhaps nothing is coincidence. So when I was a teenager, I'm going to take you back in time, in my early teens, my father's a mathematician. So he is the one who fueled love of maths in me. And so there was this theorem, Fermat's theorem, that I thought, okay, maybe I need a goal in life. And I'll just solve the theorem. It has taken, I don't know, around a couple of hundred years for no one in the world to solve it. But I was like, okay, I'll do it. And then I think when I was in my late teens, Andrew Wiles solved that the theorem was not provable. So he disproved the theorem, which was a huge shift for the maths world. But the Oxford Mathematical Institute is at the Andrew Wiles building. So it was for me almost like a fate of me going into connection with Andrew Wiles. He's also a scholar there, but at the same time to do a show in his building, even though I couldn't solve the theorem and my career trajectory has tremendously shifted during the last 20 plus years. But that was for me personally a very meaningful experience. So there was already a conversation between the Mathematical Institute and Conrad Shawcross. I know his work from before, but never had the chance of working with him until the show. Conrad also, we have this common fascination with science, such as forms of thinking, ideas in geometry, in mathematics, in physics. And in his sculptures, he does not sculpt, he constructs his sculptures, and he has this, a bit like Donald Judd, he has his own unit, and that is a tetrahedron. It's a four-dimensional or four-surfaced triangle, and that informs the work that he constructs. So it was the perfect alignment of an artistic practice that does not mimic mathematics or does not model mathematical ideas, but actually drives from them and furthers them and expands them. So that was a perfect coming togetherness. And something I want to say, and that is also perhaps like what institutions could become a bit more like, is if we were curating a museum show with Conrad, it would then take us minimum a year. We would have all the lists that's going to be shown, exact locations, etc. Whereas with Mathematical Institute, we had a free rein. We thought it was going to be a show. It ended up being the largest UK survey of Conrad, because we have more than 35 artworks that are spread across three floors of the building. And they were very open. So we could we literally kept bringing artworks, moving things around, deciding things to the last minute. And while we were installing, everybody were so curious. People wanted to come and calculate the growth ratio of his sculptures and sort the semaphore code in the beacons that he has installed, etc. So in a way, it was almost like for me, going back to engaging with maths and, I don't know, honoring that time and commitment that I had for love of maths. And now we're doing these lecture series. So we actually had our first lecture last week with Conrad and the head of the Mathematical Institute, James Sparks, who is a brilliant mathematician, but also very much interested in music and Bach. And also Martin Breidman, who works with geometrical topology and runs the Clay Institute. And it was a very interesting cross-pollination of ideas. We had a great amount of audiences and there was a lot of enthusiasm. And it wasn't about, okay, let's map art into maths or let's map maths into art. It was about, okay, how can we share knowledge that perhaps might spark a further understanding of something? Because you step outside of that confinement. This has been one of the most exciting and meaningful experiences of last year. The exhibition is ongoing, so literally it's going to be on for more than a year. And the best thing is, for instance, students, scholars, they respond to it and they have the pleasure and the privilege of having lunch with sculptures that are in their environment because it's in public spaces and common spaces, etc.
One of the other many projects you're involved in is curating the Frieze Sculpture 2023 for the major annual public exhibition that coincides with Frieze London and Frieze Masters. Would you like to tell us about Frieze Sculpture and share a little of what you plan for the upcoming exhibition?
It is early days, so we haven't made a full selection yet. So I wouldn't necessarily be able to talk about what is going to be in. But Frieze Sculpture is a very important project, and it's the only public art project of Frieze Art Fair, and it takes place for more than 2 months. So it starts earlier than Frieze Art Fair and ends afterwards. It takes place in the Regent Park at the English Garden section, and every year showcases amazing artists and a lot of great sculptures. So this year I'm approaching from an expanded notion of sculpture, and I want to not only look at what is monumental, but also what is ephemeral and what kind of fits in the spectrum. And the reason I want to do that is sculpture is the first medium that actually engages with our body. So there is that, let's say, human scale is embedded in it. And I want to really make sure that the experience of sculpture can also give an expanded conception, articulation, and realization of the medium. So I'm looking at artists who challenge the medium, or I'm looking at artists who will also incorporate other media into sculpture, such as sound, light, or performance, AR. So it's really expanding, let's say, the area of what we call sculpture. And I will be definitely working with this interplay of the site as well, that it's taking place in a park, and this malleability of the context coming forward or disappearing, or same thing for the sculptures.
You also give a number of talks and teach a number of courses. Can you tell us a little about a few of these and what you find most rewarding about them?
As you have gathered by now, I tend to talk a lot, and I have always a lot to say. And also, I try to make sure that with all my projects, I can at least take 5 hours of talking stock. So I can tell you about that. I really like thinking with people, but also sharing experiences and ideas. And sometimes I like taking the role of guiding people into thinking more about their practices. So I love doing tutorials, and people will always refer back to me as like, oh, you really pushed me there. And I like pushing people. I like encouraging them to tap into their potential. And same thing with artists, like most of the artists I worked with closely, they've done their biggest commissions with me. And then that encourages them to go bigger. So with lectures, I'm very interested in, first of all, identifying what is it that I want to give and convey. And then I really look for 300-degree engagement. So last week, I delivered a 3-day lecture program for Christie's Education, and that was called Fundamental Principles of Curating. And it was pretty intense 3 days, I have to say, and we covered a lot of ground. But something that was very rewarding was that when at the end of the sessions, we were talking with the participants, that they were saying they expected something super boring and a bit flat. And then they were so pleasantly surprised and then engaged. And they didn't only think about art, but philosophy, and also about some life wisdoms and approaches. And I think that makes me so very happy to be able to trigger that or catalyze that kind of response.
Is there anything you'd like to share about an upcoming exhibition or project with our audience?
At the moment, my passion is to finish the book because I've been working on it for a long time, and I have a couple of months left to say farewell to the manuscript and then see it materialized in tangible form. I'm very excited about that. So that's the project that's exciting me. And of course, Frieze is exciting me a lot. It's going to be my first time, and I'm really bringing a different vision to Frieze sculpture. Hopefully, it's going to be an addition that people feel excited and enthusiastic about. And I have some other projects, but they're mostly at different levels, or I keep continuing my roles. And there's one more that is very important, and that's also a passion project that's coming forward very strongly, is after the pandemic, I felt even more radicalized in thinking that we talk about change that needs to happen, but sometimes we don't put the active effort and energy in it. So I started a new alliance with two artist colleagues called Frank Fair Artist Pay. So we are actually working on fair practice and bettering fair practice in the arts in the UK. So that means fair pay, fair remuneration for labor, professionalism, time, energy commitment from the artists. But also it means fair working conditions, fair contracts, transparent and hopefully candid working relationships that could be fostered through us. So that is also a passion project that I'm working on right now. And it's a community interest company. So we're basically working on bettering the conversation. We have amazing founding members, and we've been onboarding initiation members that are composed of public institutions, commercial galleries, artists. And also we're looking at funding bodies as well, because it is very important that if you want change happen, then it needs to be a holistic embracement of change, working on that as well.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for sharing your fascinating story and valuable insight with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure as well. Thank you for your interest and for inviting me to take part in your program. Looking forward to listening to it and listening to your other interviews as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.
Have you any idea of the value of the instruments you've broken?
In actual equipment smashed and useless, I would say probably at least 6,000 quid.
You know? Now, why basically do you do this? Is it just to build excitement?
When we first started, we were looking for ideas which were big musically and visually, and eventually we just started to smash it, and it went down so well that we've been doing it ever since.
You're listening to CJUM FM 101.5, broadcasting at 1200 watts from the University of Manitoba. Remember, no matter what your mother told you, smashing things is good.
Southern wind, and I'll be the one crying.